We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Umut Asi, Professor of Psychology. My research focuses on special educational needs and mental health in childhood and adolescence. All listeners to this, and indeed any of ACAM's podcasts, are eligible for a free CPD certificate. Do please visit acamlearn.org for details of this, together with information on how you can access hundreds of hours of free talks, lectures, interviews, all of which you can also get free CPD certificates for. The web address is acamlearn.org. That's acamhlearn.org. Today I'll be speaking to Professor Pete Etchell, Professor of Psychology and Science Communication at Bath Spa University in England. Professor Etchells is the author of the book Unlocked, The Real Science of Screen Time and How to Spend It Better. This will be the focus of today's podcast. Pete, thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you for having me.
Do you want to start by just telling us a bit about who you are and what you do?
As you say, I'm a professor of psychology and science communication. I guess I'm a bit of a non-traditional professor in many ways, in that I think if you look at most professors' CVs, there's bazillions of pounds worth of grants and papers and things like that. I'm a psychologist by background, but really my interest is in practical on-the-ground science communication. So that's where I focused my work over the past 10 years or so. So for about 5 years, I ran the Guardian Science Blog Network. That was really cool. I missed doing that. That was basically about 20 or 30 scientists and science writers had the keys to the Guardian's website. We could literally write about whatever we wanted to, whenever we wanted to, with basically no editorial oversight. It was a terrifying thing to do, but it worked, and we got to write about really cool science stuff. So that was fun. And then once that closed down, I sort of moved into more longer form writing, really. So I wrote a book in 2019 called Lost in a Good Game, which is all about why we play video games and what they can do for us. I've always been interested in digital technologies and their impacts, their psychological impacts. Things like, what their effects on mental well-being are, mental health, behaviors as well. So that's where my research has been focused over the past 10 years as well. So I try and do both side by side, really. So a bit of research, but thinking about how do we talk with people about really complicated topics in science, in psychology in particular, things that people care about, but the science is really not unidirectional. It's not saying, very much the case that this thing is true. How do you navigate those very difficult conversations in such a way that people can take something useful from it and apply that to their daily lives?
Excellent. And you've already touched upon this a bit. And why is there a need for this book now?
It's a great question. There's been growing concerns around screen time for well over 10 years. But increasingly so since just before the pandemic. So this is something that I've always taken an interest in, both from a research perspective, but also in terms of, talking about it and talking with people about it in the mainstream media. And what I've noticed is that there's always been murmurings around screen time as a broad concept, feeling a little bit unwholesome and a little bit unnatural and not great for us. And then about 6 or 7 years ago, those concerns really exploded and there was this real concern. So I often go back to an article that was published in The Atlantic magazine. I think it was 2017. And the reason that I go back to that so often is because it was one of the most widely shared science opinion pieces across the entire internet that year. Like it's hard to overstate how impactful that article was, that was talking about how smartphones have destroyed a generation. And this really gels with how we feel about screens and social media and smartphones, that they're not good for us and they're really not good for kids. And then we had this weird blip, which was the pandemic, where everybody was forced onto screens to connect with each other. So I wrote an opinion piece just at the start of the pandemic for the New York Times, which was basically like, don't freak out about quarantine screen time. My quiet hope was that because we're sort of being forced to engage with this, for work or for connecting with family members, you're going to have to use WhatsApp or FaceTime or something like that. We're going to have to come face to face with this. That maybe what that would generate is more nuanced understandings of how we use screens and what their impacts are. And that might lead to a more rational, more sensible discussion and debate about how do we regulate these technologies and how do we make them work for us? And then 2024 happened and that didn't come about, right? So what's happened over the past, well, 9 months, year or so, is that there has been a real explosion in concerns, particularly focused at children and young people around their use of smartphones and social media in particular, but it also bleeds out into, you know, video games and anything digital tech, really. We've got these panicked worries now that things are really bad and they've gotten really bad really quickly and we need to do something about it now and we need to fix it now. And what we're reaching for in that panic state is very heavy-handed regulations around the nature of things like bans. It's funny because over the past 10 years or so, these issues, these worries have been bubbling under the surface. And for whatever reason this year, and I'm not sure what the particular reason is, that they've just kind of exploded.
I think I'm guilty of this, and I imagine lots of people are in the general population are guilty of this, and also researchers. So I think we should start by just thinking about some of the terms that you will be using and we will be using in this conversation. So in your book, I think you make a distinction and you explain that screen time is one term, social media is another term, digital technology, and there's lots of different terms that are used to probably describe social media, I think is probably what people are getting at, but actually there's lots of different words that people use. What are the terms that we're going to use in this conversation and what is the distinction between them?
Probably all of them and probably interchangeably. So I'm a massive hypocrite, right? So I talk about this in the book about how screen time is essentially a meaningless concept because it means so many different things. And I spend quite a long time making this argument and then I finish it off by saying, but I'm going to use screen time anyway to mean all these things. That's part of the problem, right? Because we need a shorthand way of talking about all of these sorts of digital technologies. And one of the major issues I think we have with having sensible conversations about the positive or the negative, the intricate impacts of digital tech is that we don't really have a good language, a good set of terms to talk about these things. I've often wondered since Unlocked was published, actually, that maybe it was published about a year too late or 6 months too late, because yeah, the focus in that book is very much on screen time. I don't think people care that much about screen time as a concept anymore. You know, when you have somebody like me come along and say, you know, we're going to measure like an hour of screen time, well, that's meaningless because 1 hour for me is different for 1 hour for you. An hour on Instagram is different to an hour playing Minecraft and yada, yada, yada. Everybody goes, well, yeah, obviously. Yeah, we all know that, right? That's a complete straw man argument to make. And I get that. At the same time, we're having lots of worries at the minute about social media. And I would say that social media is a similar useless term, because so many different things are social media. And again, I go into this in the book that, you know, if you're trying to tackle this from an evidence-based scientific perspective, you need to be specific about what it is that you're measuring, what it is that you're worried about. And we're not in these conversations. Facebook is very different to Instagram, purely in terms of like how you interact with it. One is a very kind of audiovisual medium. One is more, well, a mix. Facebook's more of a mix nowadays. But, you know, if you compare that with something like WhatsApp, which is more text-based, some of these are platforms where you primarily talk to and with people that you know, close family and friend members, whereas others are more parasocial in nature. You know, you're talking with people you don't know, you're talking with celebrities, people that you look up to, things like that. Some of them, the message disappears really quickly. You know, it's not permanent. Others they really are. And you think about all the different ways in which you can kind of curate those sorts of feeds. Some of them, you know, Twitter, Instagram, we're very much concerned about the way that information is algorithmically presented to us. Something like Blue Sky is much more individualistic in that there isn't an algorithm managing what you're shown. It's up to you to decide what you see. All of those different factors and different ways in which we might conceptualize a social media platform, you would imagine have very different impacts on people in terms of their psychology. But we're not having that conversation. We're saying social media is bad or social media has this effect. And you know, I have some really great conversations with parents about this. And my deep sense is that, you know, people get all of this sort of stuff, but they're just really worried, primarily by a lot of stuff that you see in the news. And you know, the fair criticism there is, so what? Why are we having this very nerdy, boring conversation about how we define something. Why do we care? Yeah, that's a, you know, it's the classic like academic ivory tower. This is very wonderful and interesting that you're saying that we need to be defining these things more properly, but I don't care. And my response to that is that you just need to look at what happened in Australia. There's been rushed legislation pushed through in Australia to ban all under 16-year-olds from social media. And there was a news story that it kind of got lost in the noise a little bit. Well, you actually look at what the legislation says, and it doesn't really define what social media is. So the next thing that happened was that you had companies like Snapchat, actual social media companies like Snapchat, coming out and saying, we're not social media, because by these definitions, we're a messaging service, therefore we would be exempt from these rules. Snapchat's one of the things that people are worried about, right? And we're talking about putting in legislation where it doesn't apply to that particular platform. And I'm sorry, but that is why having these very boring, niche, nerdy conversations about what you mean and what you're worried about in terms of impact are really important. Because if you don't take care and pay attention to the details, you end up banning the wrong thing or focusing on the wrong thing or missing the things that you're actually caring about. And it's part of the reason why we have such a mixed evidence base. All of this work started using screen time as a concept generally, right? Because it makes sense. Doesn't tell you anything useful. Doesn't mean anything. Like it's a complete red herring measure. But we're still stuck on it. And, you know, I see papers every week coming out that is just the same study over and over again. It's a bunch of researchers asking lots and lots of people, how much time have you spent on TikTok? What's your well-being like? I'm doing a correlation, as though that is useful. And we're at the point now where that sort of research is just pointless now.
My follow-up question was going to be this. So there's a group of researchers who suggest that social media, screen time, digital technology is bad for young people's mental health. And you've highlighted one potential flaw with that argument, which is that how are we defining the exposure here? Is it screen time? Is it what are they doing on social media? All of those things, what the platform is. What are some of the, in your view, some of the other flaws or problems with the argument that social media, screen time, digital technology is bad for young people's mental health?
I would say that the major problem that really is the kind of foundation for all of the other issues, I think, is that we're asking the wrong question. The questions that we ask or the statements that we make are social media is bad for mental health. And then the nitty gritty of that, when you kind of get into debates with people, then drills into what aspects of social media, what types of social media, one side of the equation. And what do you mean by mental health? Bad outcomes generally on the other side. And this is why it sort of made it very difficult to have nuanced conversations about this over the past year or so. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with journalists about in this very same way, right? You know, trying to understand and unpack what is it that's a problem? What are we worried about? What are we concerned about? And you'll start off by saying, well, you know, people are worried about social media impacting adolescence in terms of suicide rates or suicidal ideation or something like that. And then you'll go into the details of that research. You know, you can kind of make, you know, there's evidence that rates are going up. There's some evidence that rates are going down or staying stable in some populations. It then sort of goes into an even niche, nerdier conversation about how do you interpret data? What are the most appropriate data to select? But then the goalposts shift. You say, okay, well, that's the conversation about suicide, but what about depression or what about body image? Or as all these things are the same, you end up kind of constantly running around somebody shifting the goalposts, you know, and it'll veer out of mental health. It will start talking about educational attainment or cyberbullying. And then you start getting into a conversation around that's not social media necessarily, but it's smartphones as a proxy measure for social media. And it's not about smartphones generally, it's about smartphones in schools. And it becomes really difficult to navigate that space because all of these things are really different, right? These are all very different ways to think about this relationship that require different forms of data, different types of evidence, different types of methodologies and things like that. But you get stuck because it's all about digital tech on one side and bad stuff on the other side. My feeling is that if you look at the broad research in this area, it all largely takes the same sort of format, right? Which is that I should caveat this by saying it's really hard to do research on digital tech in terms of its psychological impacts, right? I can't overstate that enough, like how hard it is to do a good study in this area that actually gets at the questions and the measures that you want it to. for reasons that I'll explain in a minute. What that means is that we often fall back on less appropriate measures. And I should say, you know, I do this in my own research as well. We tend to ask them questions like, how much time have you spent on screens? Or if you're being more nuanced about it, how much time have you spent on TikTok in the past day? And we'll ask them about their mental health, or whatever it is that we're interested in. You get the very basic stuff where you ask like 60 undergrad students to report those, all the way up to thousands or tens of thousands of people being surveyed over long periods of time as a part of, you know, bigger longitudinal studies. So there are vast data sets at play in this sort of space. But they all essentially do the same thing, right? Which is they ask those questions. And we know from various lines of research that if you ask somebody how much time they spend on a screen, or on social media, they will give you a number. Of course they will. Whether that has any bearing on reality or not is a different question entirely. And the answer is probably not. So if you get more objective measures of screen time, so if you ask somebody how much time have you spent on your phone yesterday, they'll give you a number. If you ask them to go into the Screen Time app on their phone, and which logs how much time they've literally spent on their phone, you'll get a different number. And we know from some lines of research that the subjective measure, the self-report measure, tends to be much more strongly correlated with various measures of mental health than that objective measure, like four times as strong in some cases. What that means is that when you ask somebody about how much time they're spending on their phone or whatever, you're not actually asking them that. What you're asking them is, what do they feel about their screen use? Really, how do they feel about it? So what you find across most areas of research here is that people, if they feel as though they have a bad relationship with their phones or social media or whatever, you will get really strong correlations between how much time they say they spend on their phones and your bad outcome. And you see that in the kind of mental health, mental well-being space. You see it in the attention span space as well. You see it in the sleep space. You know, we are constantly told phones are bad for us. And so this is very deeply ingrained in our psyche now. So when somebody comes along and says, do you spend a lot of time on this thing? Yes. Do you feel good about that? No. Of course you get that. So 95% of the research literature is based on research that sort of takes that approach. And I realize this has been a very long, rambly answer to your question, which has not answered it yet, which is, you know, the main problem here is that we're asking the wrong questions, right? So that's what happens if you get stuck in that frame of, is social media or is digital technology X or Y good or bad for you? Because the answer will always be a little bit yes and a little bit no, right? I don't think anybody in this space is saying, actually, digital tech is fine for us. We don't need to worry about this. It's not a problem. I don't think anybody is saying that because it's silly. It's like, of course it will have an impact on us. But that's not a useful answer, right? The answer is, yeah, it has some positives and it has some negatives, but, you know, depends. What we need to be asking more in the research space and in our day-to-day lives, in these conversations we have every day, is why? Why is it that some people really thrive online, really thrive on social media, and other people who might seemingly be in similar situations really struggle? How do we identify what those vulnerabilities are, what those at-risk profiles are? And what we can then do, if we did that properly, is go, well, this is how you develop platforms that give people those positive experiences. They don't impact on those, but they provide buffers. They support people with vulnerabilities. They support everybody's psychological vulnerabilities in the space rather than playing into them. And I think if we could have those sorts of conversations, those more nuanced conversations, and get that more nuanced understanding, you know, I have this conversation a lot, and people who don't necessarily agree with this line of thinking go, oh, you're just an apologist for big tech. You're letting big tech off the hook here by saying we need to do more research, we need to do more individually. I actually think it's the opposite, because I think big tech is being let off the hook at the minute because we're having these very silly conversations, right? You know, saying things like smartphones are rewiring kids' brains is such a demonstrably false thing to say from a research perspective, that as a tech company, you can go, well, this is silly because I can point to this research evidence that shows that this is a silly thing to say. I'm not interested in this conversation anymore. We're out. I'm going to disengage. And that doesn't help anybody. Whereas if you can go, actually, nobody's saying that. What we're saying is that in these situations, these sorts of mechanisms, these sorts of factors that are obvious and they're evidenced and demonstrable in a social media platform are not good for people. They're particularly not good for people in this situation. You need to do more about fixing that. That's a much harder thing to ignore, because we're not saying all social media is bad, because it's not. We all get positives out of social media.
Thank you. And I think what I got from your book was it's not that the research says, and you're supporting that, social media is or isn't bad for you. It's that we just don't have the evidence base to come to a conclusion about this because of lots of the things that you've described so far around measurement issues, around the kinds of research questions that people are asking. And one of the things that you touch upon in your book is the inferences that then people make from the evidence that's out there. And there's some conversation around causation and correlation. Do you just want to touch on that a bit?
Well, I think that goes back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of, you know, the vast majority of the research in this area is what we call cross-sectional and longitudinal. So it's essentially either you get a bunch of people at a single point in time and ask them how much time are you spending on screens and what's your mental health like. I mean, that's a vast oversimplification, but that's basically what you do. Or you do a similar sort of thing, but over time, you track people over time. Now, those studies are great as a starting point, but I think we've never moved past that. The whole kind of correlation isn't causation argument. I'm sure everybody's tired of that, but it's this idea that, you know, if you report high levels of screen time and you report poor mental health, which is causing which? And we default to, well, it must be the high levels of screen time causing poor mental health, because that fits with our lived experience in a way, right? We have all got stories to say of spending too much time on Instagram or whatever. That this idea that it's the screens causing bad thing to happen really fits with all of our experiences of not having a good time on social media. It could be the other way, though. And there is evidence to support this, right? That actually it's more of like a reciprocal relationship. You know, there's a paper that if you're feeling low, you're more likely to go online and almost like seek out negative content that then makes you feel worse. And you get stuck in that cycle. So the argument that I make in the book is that trying to frame this as is X causing Y or is Y causing X is again, it's the wrong way of thinking about it, because it's a little bit of both. It's thinking about this in terms of digital tech or whatever you want the definition to be. Social media is very individual for different people, has the power, the potential to amplify in some cases or dampen in other cases our mood, depending on all sorts of factors. If you think of mental health is a super complicated thing. You know, it's never the case that there's one massive overriding global factor that will singularly and uniquely impact everybody's mental health in the same way. That's just not how mental health works. There are lots of things that impact mental health positively and negatively, and they all sit together in this like ecosystem of factors that interact with each other that will overall produce a net positive or a net negative. And screen time is one of those things. Whether it's a major one or not, we're not quite clear yet. There's some evidence to point that, you know, it has an impact, but it's not a massive impact. And again, this is one of the worries that I have, that the focus is so much on screens that we miss some of the more obvious stuff, particularly around kind of like adolescent mental health and things like that. We know that there are really strong, consistent factors that lead to poorer mental health in adolescence, right? Things like early childhood trauma, adverse childhood experiences, things like that have a huge impact. We don't really seem to be having a conversation about how do we support and mitigate those sorts of factors, because it's easy to focus on the screen. It's easy to go, well, you know, you see everybody like on their phones. It's a really salient thing that you see all the time. That must be the thing. Let's focus on that. Yeah, it does have an impact. It's very nuanced and complicated what sort of impact it has. If you take that away, it's not clear to me that you fix the problems that you want to fix.
This is a very interesting point, because I hadn't really thought of it like that. But when you say it, does make sense that by focusing on social media so much, it might even detract attention from the things that we know are having a negative impact on young people's mental health, because you're focusing on something that may or may not have a negative impact. And if it does, we don't know the extent of it. One of the things that I want to pick up on is earlier you talked about vulnerabilities. And one thing that I was thinking when I was reading the book was, could it just be that young people who are vulnerable in the offline space, so in the world outside of screens, are also vulnerable in the online space? And actually, if there is a negative impact, it's not the social media or the screen time. It's just those kids are vulnerable, and whether they are vulnerable offline or online, it's just where they are vulnerable. But there's a similar profile or similar type or similar vulnerability of child who's going to be vulnerable in multiple different spaces.
Yeah, we know that the specific types of vulnerabilities that children express go a long way to predicting what sorts of online risks they encounter. There's some great work by people like Ayman El-Assam at Kingston University on this. The example that I use in the book from Ayman's work is, if you look at children with caring responsibilities as an example group, these are children who spend a lot of their day at home because they've got caring responsibilities. So they're not in a kind of typical educational environment. They may be dealing with their own vulnerabilities or their own disabilities as well. Because they're at home quite a lot, they're more likely to be online for a greater proportion of the day. So the more time you're online, the more chances there are to come across something negative. Because they're in that sort of situation, there are maybe fewer chances for them to get the sort of educational scaffolding around how to stay safe online, plus maybe a relative lack of curation and scaffolding that comes from parents or their guardians because of that kind of relationship that they've got. And you put all of those things together, and what you find is that kids who've got those sorts of caring responsibilities are more at risk of cyber scams and identity fraud and identity theft and things like that. And you can kind of see what the pathway to that is. It lends itself to this idea that our offline lives mirror our online lives in quite important ways, sometimes in ways that we don't necessarily notice. And to me, that suggests quite strongly that you can extrapolate out to everybody in a sense and go, you know, when we feel, you know, regardless of, you know, what our background is in terms of physical or mental health vulnerabilities, when we feel as though we've not had a good time on our phone or on social media or whatever, are there echoes of something that's happened that day or that's going on in the background in our lives that maybe kind of precipitate that? You see this in other realms as well, right? So, you know, you take cyberbullying, for instance. Cyberbullying is awful. It's really insidious. It happens in places that should be safe spaces for kids. It happens at home. It happens anywhere, right? That's the point of it, because you can be targeted anywhere where you've got your phone. But we also know that there's a lot of overlap between online and offline bullying. So 90% of kids who report that they are bullied online also report that they're bullied offline as well. 90% of kids who report being bullies say that they bully offline as well as online. You know, there's a huge overlap there. You know, it makes sense, right, in terms of like the social relationships that develop leading up to bullying occurring. You know, they don't happen in isolation. They are intricate and they're interacting. So, you know, it makes sense to me that you get that massive sort of overlap. And that's why I go back to this idea of, you know, thinking about why is it that some people come across these negative experiences and aren't able to weather them online and other people aren't. And that's part of it. You know, if you look, there's a growing line of research around this idea of the digital divide. There are massive inequalities across the board everywhere, right? But in terms of digital accessibility and digital education, you see big disparities, you know, even in terms of basic work, looking at this in terms of socioeconomic status, right? So we know that household income is a predictor of mental health. We also know that household income is a predictor of how accessible digital tech is as well. And we know that the experiences that you can have with digital tech can impact mental health. Even there, there's quite an intricate web you can weave, a diagram you can draw, connecting all of those things with feedback connections and things like that. But we know from some studies that kids from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds have less access. Something like in the US, kids from lower SES backgrounds have like 70% of them have access to phone or a laptop in the home. It's upwards of 90% for higher income household kids. Despite that, kids from lower income households are more likely to spend more time online. So about an hour and a half more per day using digital tech, but about 50% less time using digital tech for homework. So you see these kind of disconnects between access, ability to use, type of use, amount of use, all of those sorts of things that are, you know, really important factors to consider in all of this, because what's happening underneath that is that this is research by Candice Odgers, who's amazing in this space in the US, that basically this is argument that people in higher resource homes have the time, the space, the resources to curate their kids' experiences online, whether that's in terms of education, around online safety, providing the space to talk, providing a support network. Kids from lower resource income homes, for various reasons, they just don't have the access to. That lack of resourcing and scaffolding both means that your increased likelihood of coming across something negative or potentially harmful or problematic online, just because you come across something like that online doesn't mean you are going to be harmed by it, but you are also, you know, you need other things. You need support networks in place to weather those sorts of events. And those are less available as well. So it's all of these things together that lead to ultimately, do you get a harmful outcome or not? And again, like even in this conversation, we're talking about harm. We're talking about this entirely in terms of negatives. What we've got relatively little research evidence for in this space, but we know that it's there. If you talk to kids, if you talk to them about what they use their tech for and what they get out of it, they have really important insights in this space. They know that there are horrors out there and they are worried about them. They are worried about the relationships that they're developing with their technology. They're worried about those being unhealthy, but they also see the benefits that they get from these forms of tech as well. But it's also a way for them to be creative as well. You know, a lot of kids express their creativity through social media and through kind of the sorts of things that they post on there and the artwork and things like that. Digital technology is not going away. So, you know, they need to learn how to navigate this effectively, better than we did, basically. Social media, iPhones, Android phones, whatever, they didn't come with a manual on how to use them in a healthy way. We just tried to figure it out as we went along. And I don't think we did a particularly good job of that. I don't think we're equipping younger generations with that sort of manual in the same way. We're saying you shouldn't use this stuff because it's too bad. And I totally get where that comes from. It's way more complicated than that. When you talk to them about what they use their tech for, there's so much interesting stuff there and so much good that comes out of it as well.
Yeah, I think that's really important there, because I think one of the things I was going to ask you, and you've answered this already, is the value in talking to young people via qualitative research around their experiences of using social media and the positives and the negatives that they get from that and what they feel about that. Because I think a lot of the research that I've read in your book and other books and research papers is quite quantitative and looking at the relationships between X and Y whilst controlling for Z or whatever it might be. But actually, if we talk to people and young people and ask them of their experiences, it might get to the point of us asking the right questions, because that's what you touched upon earlier on, as in like we intuitively and automatically go to what are the negatives of this and then measure those things. But actually, if we speak to young people, we might get to a point where we realize there are lots of positives with this potentially, and then we investigate those positives. Because, you know, like even in the quantitative space, I'm not that familiar with the topic, but I imagine there probably isn't as much on the positive associations of social media use, digital tech, what you do online, with positive aspects of psychological functioning as there is the negative. And that might be driven by the fact that we intuitively go to what's wrong with this. I just want to move on, just to wrap up. If we think about your take-home message, what is your take-home message for our listeners, but also if there are people who are policymakers, practitioners, even parents?
I tend to default here to saying first and foremost, don't panic. And I know that we're in a space at the minute where it feels like we're at a tipping point and everybody is worried, we need to do something right here, right now. But I think it is possible just to take a step back for a second, breathe, and try and look at this. And what I mean by this is either the whole debate or your own individual use or your use in across family members, friends, and things like that. Just sort of take a step back and take a breather at the minute and think about how do we turn this conversation around a bit so that it's not all doom and gloom, but we can think about how do we maximize the positives of our tech use and minimize the negatives. Again, this is not me being an apologist for big tech or anything like that. I do think they have some very, very serious questions to answer about the way that they develop these platforms. How we turn that ship around, I think, is going to take quite a long time. And I think at the same time, there are immediate things that we can do in our own lives that help with this. Part of it is around thinking about the language that we use and the way that we communicate with each other about digital tech. There's a great irony here that these are fundamentally communication media and we are really bad at communicating about them. Being open and transparent about what we get, you know, bad and good, out of our own tech use, I think can be really revealing. It's really hard. Those sorts of conversations often come with a sense of guilt or shame. because we're so used to thinking about we're doing this thing too much or it's bad for us. But I think being more open and transparent about our tech use can really kind of break some of those boundaries down. Part of it for me is shifting our frame of thinking around, I've lost track of the number of stories that I've seen about how we're addicted to phones and social media. And we're not. Like, it's formally, clinically, it is not a thing. The only formalized digital addiction is gaming disorder. And even there is a massive disagreement in the research literature about what it is, how you define it or diagnose it, whether it's its own unique disorder or better represented by something else. WHO formalized that in the International Classification of Diseases like 6 years ago, but we're still having debates and disagreements and arguments about what that actually is. On the WHO's own website, they link to a 2020 systematic review of like 160 studies on this, 35 different ways of measuring gaming disorder. Not one, 35. And if you look at the prevalence rate, it's anywhere from about 0.2% to something like 57.5% of the gaming population. So you're saying that either basically nobody has it, or two out of every three gamers has gaming addiction, basically. That says to me that you don't know what you're measuring. And that's for the one formalized digital addiction. We're not even at that point yet for social media or smartphone addiction, whatever. But everybody talks about being addicted to their tech, and not only being addicted to it, but that it's addictive by design. And the social media companies really don't help themselves in this space, because they also talk about it in these ways. You know, I think there's some sort of story that got leaked out of TikTok a while ago that made the news because it was saying that TikTok, you know, say that it only takes like 36 minutes to get addicted to the platform. And that's a horrifying thing to say, right? How terrifying is that? But that's because of the framing that we're using. It's not because these things are actually necessarily addictive. And I appreciate that's a really hard sell for people. I appreciate that probably at this point in the podcast, there are a lot of people going, I don't like this guy anymore. Like, this is just ridiculous. I know it's a hard sell because I know it's so ingrained in the way that we talk about this. I spend a lot of time unpacking that in the book. My feeling is that the evidence base just doesn't support these things being addictive. What it does support is that they are habit forming. Habits are a different thing. There are kind of overlaps between habits and addictions, but what we're fundamentally talking about here is things that start off as neutral habits, like checking your phone is a neutral habit. Whether it becomes a bad or a good habit depends on other things that are going on, other factors. So if you are checking your phone in the evening when you're feeling lonely and you want to connect with friends, good habit. Checking your phone because you're bored and you just want to see if there's a funny cat video on Instagram when you're driving down the road, really bad habit to get into, disastrously bad habit. It's not the thing itself, it's the situational factors around it. The thing about habits is that you can change them. They're really hard to change, but you have power over that. If you frame your thinking around digital tech as, I am addicted to my phone and it's because of the way that it's designed that this has happened to me, that is such a disempowering message. Because the only solution there, realistically, if that's what you seriously think, is to get rid of it and for the government to be involved in that in terms of top-down regulation, which are very, very hard things to do successfully. And we know from the digital detox literature that they don't work. You know, just abstinence doesn't work, not in the long term anyway. If you think about this in terms of habits, then we can still have conversations about what government regulation should look like to improve these platforms. Absolutely, and we should do that. At the same time, you can do something about it yourself. You can think about, well, what are the positives that I get about? When I'm engaging in this habit, when am I having a good experience? How do I keep those? When am I getting a bad experience and why? And that takes effort and it takes reflection and it takes being open and talking and having conversation about it. But I think it leads to more sustainable outcomes, because what you do then is not get rid of the technology, which is actually quite useful for us all. I know it's a bit of a weird thing to say, but we actually like using this tech. You know, there are positives that we get out of it. You can have fun on your phone or on your computer or on your video game console, right? You know, these things are designed fundamentally to be technologies of pleasure or convenience or entertainment. And use and goals that don't align with those ideas, how do we pull them out of our lives, basically, out of our use? And like I say, again, it's really hard to do. I'm not saying that things are going to get magically fixed overnight if you take that approach. But hopefully over time, what you see is having better conversations with the people around you, better, more reflective self-use, and you feel happier using this sort of tech.
Thank you so much. That's a really wide-ranging conversation there. I think that really what I'm taking away from this is that there are lots and lots of unanswered questions in this space. We are a long way in terms of research from figuring out whether social media is good or bad for young people's mental health. And we just need to be asking the right questions, different questions, and have an open mind and an ongoing conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues. Please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.